Okay, let's move on to the chapter on inflammation now. And here's the way I want you to handle this chapter. I want you to divide in your mind into acute inflammation versus chronic inflammation and sort of keep them separate. But know that in the body, they often are intertwined, okay, and inseparable. Okay, let's start with acute inflammation first. Let's talk about the general rules. First of all, it tends to occur very rapidly. It's an immediate response to injury. It tends to be short in duration. And finally, you got to know the cardinal signs and symptoms. Remember your rubor, calor, tumor, dolor, and functio lacessa. Okay, the redness, heat, swelling, pain, and loss of function. What are the important components that make up acute inflammation? Well, there are mainly three. There are the hemodynamic changes of the blood vessel. That's number one. Number two are the neutrophils. And finally, the chemical mediators. And there's a whole gamut of chemical mediators we'll be talking about. Okay, let's first start with the blood vessel. What are the changes? The immediate changes are there's always a transient vasoconstriction. That's the first change that occurs with acute inflammation, which is followed by a massive vasodilatation. Okay. What mediates the vasodilatation? Well, histamine's a big one. Bradykinin also plays a role, and so do certain prostaglandins. But of those, histamine's the most important. Next thing that's going to occur is not only is the vessel going to dilate, but it's also going to become permeable. And many different substances are going to be able to leak out, including cells, complement, immunoglobulin, and so forth. Some of the chemical mediators of permeability are the vasoactive amines. Again, histamine, very important, serotonin, bradykinin, and finally some of the leukotrienes. The next thing that's very important for the blood vessel is that as the blood vessel increases in size and fluid starts to leak out of the vessel, the actual flow through the vessel is going to decrease. You're going to have stasis. That is important because it's going to allow the cells to marginate and to be able to get out of the blood vessel. Okay, let's move on to the most important cell for acute inflammation. It's the neutrophil. Neutrophil has a lot of cool names. They call them leukocytes. They call them polys, polymorphonucleoleukocytes. Okay? Many different names, same cell. Now, why is this cell so important? Well, because look at the granules that it contains. It contains azorophilic primary granules, and it contains secondary, specific granules. Let's take a look at what's in the primary granules. There's a whole list of things. Probably the most important is myeloperoxidase. It's going to be very important for killing bacteria. What else does it contain? Ah, phospholipases for breaking down membranes. It contains lysozyme, acid hydrolases. Remember, that'll be important for digesting tissue and forming liquefaction of tissues. What else? Ah, elastase. It can break down elastic fibers. In fact, in smokers who have long-standing exposure to smoke, all the chemicals from smoke will actually cause neutrophils to come into the lungs. They will release elastase, the elastic tissue of the lung will break down, and that's the reason why smokers develop emphysema. It's due to the elastase. What else do they contain? Defensins and bactericidal permeability increasing protein. Again, important for killing bacteria. Let's move on to the secondary or specific granules. Again, it contains more phospholipase, more lysozyme. It contains LAP, leukocyte alkaline phosphatase. This chemical is going to be very important for distinguishing inflammation from a myeloproliferative disorder, CML. Okay, it's going to be very important. Also, there is collagenase, lactoferrin, and B12 binding protein. Okay, so a PMN, think of it as a big bag of enzymes. It's going to come into the area and release all these different substances. Okay, what inflammatory cell always will follow neutrophil no matter where it goes? It's the macrophage. Macrophage will always follow it in, and it will help phagocytize bacteria and destroy any dead tissue or non-viable areas. Okay, so it's important for phagocytosis and destruction of the surrounding tissues. Okay, let's talk about the different steps in a neutrophil coming to an area of inflammation. The first step is called margination. All that means is that think about the blood as being a highway. Here's your neutrophil. It's circulating on the blood highway. It needs to change lanes and move over to the edge of the column of blood flow. We call that margination. In fact, sometimes you'll see them lining up along the surface of a blood vessel. We call that pavementing. The next step is it's going to actually adhere to the endothelial layer of the blood vessel. Okay? And how is it going to adhere? It's going to use the adhesion molecules, which we'll talk about in a moment. Next thing I want you to look at is step 3. Neutrophils are going to be stimulated by various cytokines. The cytokines is going to help upregulate on the surface of the neutrophil various integrins and selectins. It's going to help the neutrophil be more sticky. Okay? And finally, the cell is actually going to attach firmly to the surface by binding to the integrins. Okay. Now, in your handout, there is a chart. The chart lists the various selectins and integrins found on endothelial cells and on leukocytes. Do you need to know this for the boards? You bet you do. Okay, they've asked about these. Let's start with the selectins. Now, the selectins are the initial binding molecules. Okay, there are selectins on the neutrophil, and there are also selectins on the endothelial cells. When those come in contact with each other, the cell will start to stick, but it will continue rolling on the surface of the blood vessel. So selectins are important for the rolling motion. What are the selectins? Well, on the endothelial cell, there's P-selectin and E-selectin. E stands for endothelial. Okay, it's a great way to remember E-selectin is on endothelium. For the leukocyte, I want you to remember L-selectin. L stands for leukocyte. Okay, that's where you'll find it. Okay, the next step is the attachment of the integrins. Okay, and that is a very firm binding. When the integrins attach, the leukocyte will stop rolling. It will stop, firmly adhere, and now the cell can actually migrate through the blood vessel wall. So what are the specific integrins? Well, if you look on the endothelium, there's ICAM and VCAM. V stands for vascular. Okay, great way to remember that's on endothelium. For the leukocytes, you got to remember LFA and MAC1 and VLA-4. Okay, those are the important integrins. Let's talk about what increases the stickiness or what upregulates these molecules. Well, the first thing that upregulates the molecules on the endothelial cells are chemicals such as histamine. Histamine is going to cause an increase in distribution of P-selectin on the surface of endothelial cells. P-selectin is normally in the Weibull-Palladi bodies. They're within the cytoplasm of endothelial cells. When it gets stimulated by histamine, the Weibull-Palladi body will actually migrate to the cell surface and increase or upregulate P-selectin on the surface. The next thing that will increase the synthesis of some of these adhesion molecules is the production of interleukin-1 and tumor necrosis factor. Both of those cytokines are produced at areas of inflammation. They're produced by macrophages especially, but other inflammatory cells can produce those as well. Okay, what makes the leukocytes more sticky? Well, that one is usually caused by a conformational change in the integrin, especially in LF1. When it's exposed to various cytokines, the adhesion molecule will change its configuration to a high affinity binding state. Okay? Therefore, the leukocyte will want to stick a lot more. Okay, let's talk about some defects in adhesion. Okay? Every step of this process is going to have potential defects. For the adhesion step, the important defects, remember diabetes mellitus. All that sugar is going to interfere with these adhesion molecules. What else? Corticosteroid use, alcohol abuse. And finally, there's a genetic disorder called leukocyte adhesion deficiency. It's an autosomal recessive disorder where you actually have a defect in these molecules, specifically in LFA1 and MAC1. The result of this is your leukocytes are no longer sticky. So clinically, these are going to be young kids, and they're going to present with recurrent infections. Okay, let's move on to the next step. The leukocyte is adhered. Its next job is to move through or migrate through the endothelium. We call that emigration. Okay? And it does that by using pseudopods and by using various proteolytic agents to get through the basement membrane. Next area is chemotaxis. Once the leukocyte is moved out of the blood vessel, it has to move to the area that it's needed. It does that by following a chemotactic gradient. It just follows it along. Okay? What are some of the important chemotactic factors that they love to test on the exam? Well, there are four important ones. The first one are bacterial products, especially products that have N-formyl methionine at the end. Next is a leukotriene. It's leukotriene B4. The next one is a product of the complement cascade. It's C5A. And the final one is an alpha chemokine. It's called interleukin 8. It's usually produced by macrophages. It's a great way for a macrophage to call in leukocytes. Okay, let's move on to phagocytosis and degranulation. Got it. Okay, for phagocytosis, leukocytes, PMNs, macrophages, rely on opsonins. On the board exam, they love to ask about what are the three important ones. The first one, by far, is the IgG, especially the Fc component. That's a great opsonin. Another important product is a product of the complement cascade. It's C3b. And the final one is a protein produced by the liver. It's called colectin. These are proteins that bind to bacterial cell walls and aid in phagocytosis. Okay, once the neutrophil has phagocytized or engulfed the bacteria, it's going to phagocytize it into what's called a phagosome. That phagosome will fuse with a lysosome and produce what's called a phagolysosome. And then you'll have intracellular killing. Okay, let's talk about the defect in phagocytosis. The big one for the board exam is called Chediak-Higashi syndrome. This is an autosomal recessive disease. It's characterized by having neutropenia, and all the neutrophils that remain have huge, giant granules in their cytoplasm. Those are all giant lysosomes, okay? Because they have a defect with not only chemotaxis of the PMNs, but the PMNs cannot fuse the lysosome with the phagosome, okay? So problem with degranulation. Okay, let's move on to intracellular killing. For this, you got to remember oxygen-dependent killing via the respiratory burst. Okay, your body's going to use oxygen and NADPH oxidase to produce lots of free radicals, which do the killing. What are the free radicals? Superoxide's a big one, highly lethal. Hydroxyl radicals, again, very, very damaging to bacteria. And finally, hydrogen peroxide. Why is hydrogen peroxide important? Well, remember, PMNs contain myeloperoxidase. How does myeloperoxidase work? What it does is it takes hydrogen peroxide and halide, which is chloride, and it uses those to produce a new free radical, okay, called hypochlorous acid. It's HOCl, free radical. And again, that's highly damaging to bacteria. Okay, let's talk about some oxygen-independent killing. Remember we talked about lysozyme, lactoferrin, bactericidal permeability-increasing protein, and defensins. All those don't require oxygen, but they can still kill bacteria. Okay, let's talk about diseases that are important for oxygen-dependent killing. The important diseases for oxygen-dependent killing are chronic granulomatous disease of childhood. This is an X-linked or autosomal recessive disease. It's due to a deficiency of NADPH oxidase. By definition, without this enzyme, you don't have the respiratory burst. You're not going to make your superoxide, you're not going to make your hydrogen peroxide. So these poor kids develop recurrent bacterial infections, especially with organisms that produce catalase. Okay? Remember, catalase breaks down hydrogen peroxide. Okay? So these organisms are going to be very virulent in these children. Okay, one other disease is called myeloperoxidase deficiency. This is a milder disease. Okay, it's autosomal recessive, and they tend to have infections with Candida, a fungal organism. Okay, let's move on to the chemical mediators of inflammation. Okay, we'll start off with the vasoactive amines. The most important in this category is histamine. This is a board favorite. It's produced by a number of different cells, especially basophils, plasma cells, and mast cells. What's its function? Well, it's very vasoactive. It causes vasodilatation. It causes increased vascular permeability. What causes it to be released? Well, IgE-related diseases, such as the hypersensitivity type 1 reactions. Other things like anaphylaxis, like C3a and C5a, and also interleukins, especially interleukin 1, will all increase the release of histamine. Okay, let's move on to the kinin system. This is sort of a fun system. You should know it's activated by factor 12, also known as Hageman's factor. When Hageman's factor activates prekallikrein, it forms kallikrein. What does kallikrein do? Well, it will break down and cleave high molecular weight kininogen to form the end product. It's called bradykinin. Okay, the whole reason the kinin system is around is to form bradykinin. What does bradykinin do? Well, I always want you to remember, bradykinin on the exam is important for pain. It's a tremendous mediator of pain. It has other functions as well. It does do increased vasodilatation and increased vascular permeability as well. But please remember pain. Okay, let's move on to the arachidonic acid products. You'll cover this in biochemistry, but for pathology, I want you to remember for the cyclooxygenase pathway, thromboxane A2 versus prostacyclin. Here's the way I remember it. They're like opposites. Memorize one, you know the other because it's the complete opposite. Let's start off with thromboxane A2. With a name like thromboxane, it's probably being produced by platelets. What do you think it's going to do to platelets with a name like thromboxane? It's probably going to cause platelet aggregation. It's also going to cause vasoconstriction. Okay? So what's prostacyclin? It's the exact opposite. It's produced by vascular endothelium. It causes vasodilatation, and it prevents or inhibits platelet aggregation. So again, it's the complete opposite. What else is important for the exam? Prostaglandin E2. It has two major functions. It's a mediator of pain. And what's its claim to fame in utero? Well, it's responsible for keeping open the ductus arteriosus. Okay? So if we have a child who's born with a patent ductus arteriosus, what drug do we usually use to close it? We use indomethacin. How does it work? Well, it inhibits the cyclooxygenase pathway, and it prevents the production of PGE2. That's one of the way it works. Okay, let's move on to the complement cascade. Okay, you'll study this in several other areas. Other physicians get all excited about it. For the pathology point of view, the only things that are important are the end products. For instance, what's really the end product of the complement cascade? You got to remember C5b through C9 because that's the membrane attack complex. Basically, you've formed now a pore through the whole of bacteria. It's going to lead to the death of that cell. Other things that are formed along the way are also important for pathology, especially C3a and C5a. Why? They're anaphylaxitoxins. They increase the release of histamine from mast cells. What else is important? Ah, C5a. It is an important chemotactic factor for PMNs. And the final one is C3b. Remember, it's an opsonin. It's going to help phagocytize bacteria. Okay, let's move on to the cytokines. Okay, for the cytokines, interleukin-1 and tumor necrosis factor alpha are probably the most important. They are responsible for producing fever. They also will increase your acute phase reactive proteins. They enhance the adhesion molecules and help PMN stick to vascular endothelium. And finally, they stimulate a wide variety of cells, especially fibroblasts and endothelial cells. Okay, so they're going to be very important for wound healing, calling in granulation tissue. Okay, next one in your handout is interleukin 8. This is usually produced by macrophages. Why is it important? Because it calls in leukocytes, PMNs. Okay, before we leave acute inflammation, we should talk about the outcomes of acute inflammation. There's only four outcomes of acute inflammation. The first one is complete resolution with regeneration of the normal tissue. Okay, so the normal tissue regenerates itself. It looks like completely normal. Number two, you can have complete resolution of the tissue, but with scarring. Okay. Next is number three, abscess formation. This occurs when you cannot cure the infection and you have ongoing acute inflammation. Your body will wall it off and you'll have a localized collection of pus and abscess. And the final one is you can call in chronic inflammatory cells and go on to chronic inflammation. Okay, with that in mind, let's switch gears now and go on to chronic inflammation. I want you to remember that chronic inflammation has different causes. It can come about after or following an bout of acute inflammation. It can come about with persistent infections. And finally, remember certain infectious organisms. Your body will respond with chronic inflammation. For instance, viral infections. Your body uses chronic inflammation. Mycobacterium, funguses, parasites, foreign material. Okay, all those will elicit chronic inflammation. Let's move on and talk about the players, the cast of characters in chronic inflammation. The most important one is probably the macrophage. It's central to chronic inflammation. Where do macrophages come from? Well, macrophages are born in your bone marrow. They circulate in the blood as monocytes. And then they can move into the tissue, where we call them macrophages. Okay? And we give the macrophages fancy names depending on which tissue does it decide to call home. If it decides to call the lung home, we call it a pulmonary alveolar macrophage. If it calls the liver home, we call it a Kupffer cell. These are just fancy names for macrophages in different locations. In the brain, we'll call it microglia. And in the bone, we call them osteoclasts. Okay, next thing that the board has asked about in the past is whenever you have an area of chronic inflammation, where did the macrophages come from? Were they recruited from the tissue or were they recruited from the circulating blood? The answer is always they're recruited from the circulating blood. Okay, why are macrophages so important? They're incredibly important because they produce a whole gamut of cytokines. We call those monokines. And basically, they can call in acute inflammation if it's needed. They can call in chronic inflammatory cells. So they're important in acute inflammation, they're important in chronic inflammation, and when the inflammation is done, they also secrete interleukin-1 and 2 necrosis factor, which is going to call in granulation tissue. So they're sort of like the Bo Jackson of inflammatory cells. They do it all, okay? Just make sure everybody knows Bo Jackson. Maybe I'm dating myself. He was a baseball player, and he played football. He did it all. The macrophages are the same thing. They do it all. Okay, let's move on to lymphocytes. It's another important component of chronic inflammation. Remember, there are B lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, and there are also plasma cells. All those will play an important role. One thing I want you to remember is that macrophages can call lymphocytes in by using cytokines. We call them leukotaxin. That will call in lymphoid cells. Next cell is the eosinophils. Eosinophils are very important in two areas, parasitic infections and allergic reactions. Okay. The chemokine for eosinophils is called eotaxin. And why are eosinophils important for parasites? Well, because in their cytoplasm, they call what's called major basic protein. It is toxic to parasites. Okay, the last cell in chronic inflammation is called the basophil. These are found in high numbers in the lung and the skin, and they're usually around vascular structures. They play an incredibly important role in IgA-mediated diseases, especially hypersensitivity type 1. Okay, let's move on to a specialized form of chronic inflammation. It's called chronic granulomatous inflammation. Now, the board loves to ask about chronic granulomatous inflammation. Why? Because students get confused with granulation tissue. Okay? They sound the same, but they're completely different. Granulation tissue is wound healing. Granulomatous inflammation is a specialized form of chronic inflammation. Okay? Students get them confused. The board knows that. So guess what? They love to test it. Okay, what is chronic granulomatous inflammation? Well, it's composed of three at least three components. It has to have epithelioid cells by definition. That is the pathognomonic cell. What are epithelioid cells? All they are modified macrophages. They are modified by interferon gamma. They become larger. They have a lot more cytoplasm to them. Okay. The next cell that you should know about is the multinucleated giant cells. Those are basically fused epithelioid cells. Okay. The other term for them are Langhans giant cells. The final cells that you usually will see around the periphery of a granuloma are lymphocytes. Okay, especially helper lymphocytes. You can also see plasma cells there as well. Now, what diseases do your body respond to with granulomatous inflammation? Well, there's a list here. Take a look at this list. Tuberculosis is a big granuloma producer. Catch scratch, syphilis, leprosy, fungal infection, and parasitic infections. Okay, so notice that what do these all have in common? They're slow-growing organisms. Okay. Next thing that your body uses granulomas to fight are foreign bodies, such as beryllium. And the final thing that you'll see granulomas in the exam is in diseases like sarcoid or Crohn's disease, you'll see granulomas in. Okay, that covers chronic inflammation. Let's move on to tissue responses to infectious diseases. Now, when you study your microbiology, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites. I got good news for you. In pathology, your body only has five ways to respond to all those bacteria and fungi. Okay? Only five patterns under the microscope. So let's talk about them. The first pattern that your body will use when it fights bacteria especially is called exudative inflammation. Under the microscope, you'll see lots and lots of PMNs. Okay? So it's a purulent exudate. Okay? And you usually see that with bacterial infections, especially pneumonias or bacterial meningitis. Okay, the next form of change you'll see under the microscope, again, is with bacterial infections, especially virulent bacteria. And the form of inflammation is called necrotizing inflammation. All that means is under the microscope, necrosis predominates. Okay, again, it's a virulent organism. And where will you see it? You'll see it in diseases like necrotizing pharyngitis, where the infection of the pharynx is so severe that basically your whole throat becomes necrotic. And the whole tissue is just raw and basically falling off. The other place where you'll see this is in with necrotizing fasciitis. Okay, again, the organism is very virulent, and you have necrosis, especially along fascial planes. Okay, next type is a board favorite. It's called granulomatous inflammation. You got to be able to recognize granulomas on this exam. Board loves it. Remember, slow-growing organisms, especially TB. What will make TB granulomas different from all the other ones is you'll see caseous necrosis. Okay, all other granulomatous diseases tend to be non-caseating. Okay, we talked about bacteria. We talked about slow-growing organisms like Mycobacterium. We didn't talk about viruses. How does your body fight viruses? It usually does it with what's called interstitial inflammation. In other words, you'll see mononuclear cells in between the parenchymal cells. A great example of this is myocarditis due to Coxsackie virus. If you did a biopsy of the heart, you would see that the myocytes are spread apart, and in between are inflammatory cells, lymphocytes. Okay, that's how your body fights viruses. The final type is probably the coolest type. It's called cytopathic or cytoproliferative inflammation. All this means is that the infected cell has a change that you can see under the microscope. Okay? It's usually caused by a virus. And some great examples are intranuclear or cytoplasmic inclusion. For instance, in CMV, you'll see those beautiful, large inclusions within the nucleus, which basically look like an owl's eye. Another great example is in rabies. If you're out in the woods and you're walking around and you get bitten by a bat or a skunk or a raccoon and you develop rabies, if they did a biopsy of your brain, you'll see within neurons, the inclusions within the cytoplasm, we call those Negri bodies. And it's just a cytopathic change due to the virus. A couple other that are in your handout, remember, respiratory syncytial virus will cause your cells to form syncytia, meaning that the cells will actually stick together and form multinucleated cells. We call that syncytial formation, and you find that with respiratory syncytial virus. Okay, that completes that chapter. Let's now move on to wound healing and repair.